Welcome back to In Search of Tarot, a podcast that examines, questions, and reimagines our approach to life and the cards.
Through guest interviews and in-depth discussions, we'll explore and expand the beautiful complexities of spirituality, philosophy, magic, and more.
I'm Nick.
And I'm Angie.
And we're your hosts for this fascinating ride.
Thanks for being here with us.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to In Search of Tarot for the first episode of season 6 of this podcast. We have a lot of exciting things planned for you this season, a lot of amazing guests lined up that I can't wait to share with you. And we also are going to be inviting 4 guest contributing hosts to join us this year. The idea for this came from a desire that we have to expand the community that's represented on this show, to provide more space for different voices and different perspectives. And in order to get kind of outside of our own bubble, we thought that it could be useful to invite some additional contributors to think of, you know, people that they have learned from, that they've studied with, that they would like to speak with, and to bring that into the In Search of Tarot family and share those conversations with all of you. So our guest hosts for season 6 are going to be Jonathan Coe, Sam Valentine, Charlie Claire Burgess, and Maria Menes. And each month we will share 1 guest episode per month. So in these episodes, each of those contributors I just listed will either speak with another person that has been influential on them in their life, and or share some of their own thoughts on a particular topic, maybe exploring some history. There's lots of options. We've got a lot of exciting ideas kind of percolating right now, and I'm already just so excited to share these episodes with you. So in order to make that happen, something that I'm very proud of here on In Search of Tarot is that we do pay all of our guests. That is made possible through our Patreon and the generous support of those Patreon members. And this means that if we're going to include these guest contributors, I, of course, want to pay them as well. I don't want to go backwards on that. I want to only kind of move forward on that. So if you are a listener of the show, a regular supporter of the show, please consider coming on to Patreon. You can join for as little as $2 a month, and you can help us build towards a goal of $200 a month on Patreon. Right now, we are about around $115, $120 a month, so we don't have very far to go. There's a $2, $5, and $10 tier available, and patrons receive early access to all podcast episodes. They get discounts to all of my classes and workshops. They receive weekly Mystic Missive newsletters. There's a free version of that newsletter that I put out every month via email, and patrons receive a weekly version. And they also get invitations to attend monthly tarot hangs on Zoom. And something special that we are going to be doing this year is people that give at the $5 or $10 level and sustain that giving for at least 6 months are going to be receiving a little something special in the mail, a little piece of In Search of Tarot merchandise that I'm kind of, you know, geeking out on creating and excited to share with everybody. So if you want to support the show financially and support these new guest hosts financially, please consider joining us at patreon.com/insearchoftarot, and I'll put that link in the show notes. So on to my guest for today. When I asked today's guest, who is the incredible Leah Garza, if she would be interested in joining me for an interview this season, she initially voiced some concern about coming on a tarot podcast because she doesn't work with the cards. And I was really happy that she had this reaction because it made me realize that I wanted to kind of come out and clarify and be a little bit more explicit about something that I've been slowly pointing to here on the show and in my work for a while now, but that I really want to kind of clearly state. And that is that when I teach tarot and work with tarot and think about tarot, I do not believe that it's possible to separate that from any and all other ways that I might think about my life and in any and all topics that concern my life. You know, I really think that when you learn tarot or work with tarot, that really what you're doing is you're learning and working with your life. So there are no topics that are off topic. there is no conversation that does not apply, because tarot is meant to help us understand our lives. And so no element of our life should be without discussing within that. So, you know, already, if you've been a fan of the show for a while, you'll know that my guests are pretty wide ranging that I bring on. And today is no different, but that is something that matters to me. And that's something that I'm going to continue to expand on the show. And I hope it's something that you enjoy as well. And that's what, you know, hopefully brings you here. So let me tell you a little bit more about Leah Garza by reading you her bio. Many worlds exist in this one world. In one world, Leah Garza is a veteran teacher and education organizer. She's spent nearly two decades in social justice movement spaces, working toward equitable change in public education. She earned her master's degrees in education and depth psychology, and is currently working on a PhD in community, liberation, indigenous, and eco-psychologies. In another world, Leah is a shapeshifter. The trials incurred personally and collectively through the Trump administration and the later pandemic and uprisings made her a seeker. Leah learned to engage her ability to shapeshift as she began to ask questions of her purpose in this lifetime. Leah is a practitioner of the Akashic Records and offers radical healing work through the lenses of decoloniality and relational ways of being to subvert the colonial agenda. Wow. So I am currently lucky enough to be a student in Leah's Living Systems course, which is truly, truly changing my life. And I don't say that lightly. It's actually really interesting to listen to this interview now, because Leah and I recorded this back in early January, right after I had only had my very first class with her. And we sort of say in the interview, we sort of hint at, you know, oh, it'll be so interesting how different it will feel in March and who we will be in March. And I am such a different person, and it's only just begun. You know, this is only the third month of a year-long container. So I can't say enough about Leah's perspective and work and space holding ability and generosity in sharing her knowledge. As someone who, as I tell Leah in this interview, loves to learn and hates school, I just have really appreciated finding her and really appreciate the way that she shares her knowledge and decolonizes education. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. I hope you enjoy this season. Thank you so much for listening, and enjoy. Leah, you really strike me as such a multidimensional person. And that is what I'm very excited to speak with you about tonight, because I really resonate with that. And I really resonate with the way that you seem to hold like sort of a more mystical approach or a more spiritual approach with a really academic approach to life. And I'm someone, I mean, we're just getting to know each other, you know, through your Living Systems offering, but I am someone that loves to learn and hates to go to school.
That's too bad.
Yeah, I know. It's difficult. But definitely is how I feel. So, you know, I'm excited to kind of dive into all the different, you know, paths that you go down and all of your work. But something that I kind of always like to begin with is the question of just, you know, how would you describe yourself today in this, in this present moment? You know, who are you and where are you in the world today?
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me, first of all. It's like a special treat. Every time I get to be on someone's podcast, it's like being invited to a wedding. Like, you made a space for me. Like, thank you. So thank you. I don't, take those invitations lightly. I live in Los Angeles. I've lived here for, I'm going on 12 years now. I moved here in 2011 to get my master's in education and my teaching credential. And I was, you know, very deep in the world of education, especially social justice education, for a really long time. I've worked in every grade level, K through 12. I've worked with transitional age youth up to 25 years old. But I'm none of that now. I mean, I'm still teaching, but I am so far away from those worlds now. So I work for myself. I have a practice with where I have a spiritual counsel practice. I offer Akashic record readings and different healing work. But in addition to that, I'm also a PhD student, and I'm in a depth psychology program studying community liberation, indigenous and eco psychologies. And my latest stuff, which is like, this is such a weird question of like, who are you? What do? Is offering public scholarship. So I find that the stuff that I'm studying in school is one, inaccessible to most people, unless if you go into a PhD program, which very few people will do, and very few people will find the curriculum that I'm teaching, that I'm learning. And two, I think that the things I'm learning about decoloniality and about ontology are so, they're like the keys that people who come to me for services are looking for, but I didn't know. So like, to me, my job is to like be the bridge to get this stuff out to the public, like get it out to people, because we're suffering, you know, privately, silently, individually, in the healing world. We want to heal, we want to heal, we want to heal. And we just are spinning our tires because we don't have like a, I don't know, sometimes we don't have access to an imagination that lets us dream other possibilities. And for me, decoloniality and ontology, posthumanism, all the things that I study, other ways of being well, if you even want to adhere to that, have like just transformed what I even think I'm doing as a practitioner who has the audacity to work with clients, even as if I know any fucking thing. I'm sorry. Can I say the F word?
Yeah, totally. Okay.
So I've been dabbling with the words public scholar, and I still have a practice. I still see clients. My main devotional practice is with the Akashic records, so the Akashic fields. That's like what I've spent many years practicing almost on a daily basis, and done many, many trainings and a lot of teaching of it. Yeah, I don't see a separation in the spiritual and the academic.
Yep. I love it. I love everything you just said. And I, it's funny because I know that, you know, when we talked about you coming on, you know, there was sort of a question for you of like, well, why tarot? Like, I don't, yeah. You know, I don't work in tarot, but, everything you're saying is how I feel about tarot, and all of the topics that you're addressing through my own exploration of them has also made me question, you know, my work and my, how I hold space in tarot and what it means to even say that I can do that, and, you know, ways that it's appropriate or inappropriate to do that, and, you know, and,
yeah,
and all of that. So, I really think it's important for tarot, you know, practitioners to think about these things. And that's why I wanted to have you, you know, on today. We're going to talk a lot about decoloniality, but will you first explain ontology? Because that's a idea that I came to through you. So I would love to hear you explain it.
Yeah. It's the etymology, the root of the word is Greek, and it comes from like the study of being. And so it's born from the world of philosophy, and I'm not a philosopher, although I involve it in my studies. I'm not a philosopher, but the study of what counts as reality is how I describe it. And many people describe it. But when we think about what counts as reality, we're often unaware of what we count as reality. But then we just make it standard. So like, I always use the example of like, the government. Like, we know on some conscious level that the government is a construction, that people, it's not a structure of nature, but the way the government operates in our lives and in our beings and in our perception of what's real, it feels as good as nature. It feels equal to nature. It feels as stable as nature or as natural as nature. And so we never question, we might question what the government does, but we never question that it exists. Mm-hmm. And simultaneously, part of this construction of the government is this construction of our culture that says, if you question that it exists, you will be blacklisted immediately. Like, that's where we get, like, you know, McCarthyism and like the mob mentality and like, you know, just all the things that happen to us, you know, being labeled a communist as if that communism equals destroying the government. I guess it kind of does, because we're, never mind. But so, yeah, like ontology asks us to look at what we count as reality. And that's like a concept that for me, I'm like screaming it at my clients, because sometimes the things that we want to, I'm putting quotes around, heal, are really the things that the normative society, the dominant society, has told us are pathological within us, or that we're broken because of this thing. We don't fit this external standard. But that's only one version of what reality is. That's only, and we don't have to buy into that. So ontology has been really critical in like the way I see everything I do.
Yeah. And an ontological view that you share on your website and your bio is that this idea that many worlds exist in this one world. Mm-hmm. And you go on to say that you describe the multiple worlds that you see yourself inhabiting. So will you talk a little bit about that concept of multiple worlds and how you kind of see yourself fitting in that?
Yeah. I mean, all of us do that. So like, I'm in the United States. I was born and raised in a colonial ontology. There are things about me that are deeply colonial, because that's just how it is. That's how I was raised. And I'm not even mad about it. Like, oh man, I love online shopping. I love my shoes. I love, you know, like, there are things about me that I'm not, that's fine. I recognize that those are constructions of identity formed in colonialism, and simultaneously, I'm okay with it. But along with that, so like, that world is very scientific. That world is evidence-based. That world is like, we use metrics in that world. We need proof. We need physical proof. And then this other part of my existence is to be a practitioner of the Akashic realm, which is essentially to go into an energetic state of consciousness, a dimension of consciousness, to access some kind of channeled information from an invisible etheric body of information. That is totally at odds. That world in which that is true is at odds with the colonial world that demands evidence. Like, if you know this information, how, you know, like, and we know this, like, a really good example of like seeing that edge, that ontological edge in real life, is the people that are into paranormal studies. Because those are people that, like, they admit that they believe that there is spirit activity, but they won't just trust their inner knowing or their other, you know, their senses or like their intuition. They have to use scientific measures, like the, you know, the tools that record energy and the heat sensing tools and stuff, in order to prove that spirits are real. And so you can see right there, our two ontologies bumping up against each other. I did not make up this idea that many worlds exist in the one world. In fact, the Zapatistas talk about this a lot, that there's a world in which many worlds fit. And that just makes sense to me. So many of us suppress the many worlds that we live in so that we can demonstrate that we can navigate the colonial world, the surface world, the physical world, the 3D world, the science-based world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm wondering how you'll feel about a concept that I've been working with for about a year now, of kind of trying to reclaim the margin as a place of power. When people talk about like marginal identity, and it's not that I'm trying to say that being marginalized is a positive thing. That's not what I'm trying to say, but that, you know, and the reason I'm bringing it up is I really, you mentioned this in our last class, you used the word edge space. And that's one way that I've kind of looked at what the margin is. And what feels interesting to me in relation to what you're saying is that when we move away from the margin, because the margin is sort of so pure and essential and raw that it kind of can't be verbalized, you know, and like, as we start to verbalize it, we move a little away from what really is, you know, like, And I kind of see that as, you know, we were saying people are trying to sort of prove something, like that's one way of moving away, or even just trying to really understand is a way of moving away from it, you know, but I don't know. Does that ring true for you?
Yes. Yeah. Well, you're going to be just tickled when we get to our living systems class on borders, because that's essentially like what you're talking about. And when I talk about ontology, so when we get to our ontology class, like I start teaching ontology from this concept called Nepantla. Have you ever heard this word, Nepantla?
Yes.
So Nepantla is like a Nahuatl word from, you know, the Mexica culture that, you know, in Spanish we say ni de aquí ni de allá, neither from here, neither from there. And what they're talking about is liminality. Mm-hmm. And so everybody, even the people with the most social privilege, with quotes around privilege, lives in many worlds. But colonialism is so obsessed with purity, pure lineage, pure form, pure, you know, being a thoroughbred, that we disavow and ignore that we are liminal beings all the time. Mm-hmm. We go to sleep and we have dreams where our consciousness is in other places. And yet we wake up and be like, no, I'm just this conscious being, like third dimensional science being. No, every single one of us exists. Every single person is going to die and then have an experience of what happens right after that moment of death. Mm-hmm. Like we're constantly liminal. We're constantly coming from Nepantla, everybody. And so like, that has to be the center of existence, of living in many worlds. This idea that there's one world here and one world there and they overlap or they come back, even that is like a very colonial way of looking at like that there are separate worlds. Like we're all in a liminal borderland all the time.
Yeah. I do think that it's easier for certain people to hold questions of like, what is real? Like what is reality? I mean, cause you're kind of pointing to postmodernism, you know, and in a way, and I find that that line of thinking easy and invigorating, but mm-hmm. I know through my husband that other people don't, you know, and it's like, it becomes too much, you know? I mean, do you encounter that when you work with people and how do you approach that?
I mean, this dream world that I have created where I teach these courses and like-minded people find me and it's all groovy. And then there's the world of going home for Christmas and like talking to my family about things that they're like, but that's also like so beautiful to me. Like I don't need people to meet me where I'm at for me to fall in love with them at all, or just to, you know, and it's funny that you say this, cause like my dad died when I was 27, but like, I think about if he was a born again, conservative Mexican-American man, he would have been so gassed up if he had lived through the Trump administration. Like that would have been his jam. Mm-hmm. And so I often think about like what conversations we would have or are even having in some other world about what I'm learning, what I believe now, because I'm in a different world now than I was when he was alive. Mm-hmm. But yes, all the time, all the time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's talk about the edge space that you mentioned, you know, the first time you came up against that edge space through, you know, kind of learning about all of this. I mean, I want to know like what that turning point was for you, you know, when that happened and how things, you know, shape shifted for you there. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when I was a teacher, I did my teacher prep at UCLA, which is a very social justice-y school. And I was drawn to that because I was already having, I came into a politicization late in my life, I think. But everything around me was like pointing me in that direction. Like it wasn't because I was indoctrinated that I took on a social justice lens. It was because I was observing real life oppressions and reflecting on my own family's experience with oppressive systems. And I became consumed with like fairness. When I went to the first like kind of like tiny awakening, when I went to the teacher prep program, was like being taught by that program that like schools aren't broken. They're doing what they're designed to do. Mm. And that kind of like, what? Like, so, because what we had spent so much time in this country doing is like trying to fix problems, but instead of, but we're never looking at like, what are the systems that we're trying to fix actually designed to do? So that was like kind of mind blowing and helped me start shifting, being able to like pry under that ontological veil and like, look at like, whoa, this isn't what I thought it was at all. That was like the first awakening. And then I slowly started like kind of developing my own, I don't know, inclination or path toward decoloniality before I ever got to my current program. And then once I got to my current program, I was like so ready for it to just wash over me, like just take me, just dissolve me. I don't want any part of what I believe to be true anymore. I'm ready for whatever opening. And so really, like when I talk about like the curriculum being psychoactive, it's because that's what it is. Like, this isn't just stuff we learn and it stays up in our conscious minds. These are concepts that if we stick with it, and this is why the class that I teach living systems is a year long, because we need an extended amount of period to have exposure and to grapple and to chew on these concepts. And then they start to do something to us from the inside out. And we start to dissolve that purity of, I live in this world or I live in that world. And we start to see ourselves as nipanleros, and we start to see ourselves as liminal beings and understand that like the identity I wear, the social identities I wear are, have capital in one world, but in a totally different world, when I'm like in the middle of like the desert by myself with just a bunch of like rocks and cacti, they don't care about my social identities. I'm a different being that has to exist differently in that space. Mm-hmm. And, but I'm no less Leah. I'm no less me there than I am over here where I talk about my social identities. So yeah, I don't know if that answered the question.
Yeah, totally. You mentioned Akashic Records. Is that something that you were working in before you started your learning about all of this? Or
Yeah. I was a teacher up until 2015. My school closed and I had a very rough go of finding a job after that. And I realize now and believe now that it was because I was meant to take a hard turn and be doing the work I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. And I would never have quit because I was such a like work. Don't ever quit. Don't, who cares if you're uncomfortable, just keep working. I had to be pushed off that course. And then in my, like, I don't know, the first couple months of unemployment, I was like, I'm gonna have fun and get unemployment and just take a cool, like take a cool spiritual class, learn how to metalsmith, just like have some me time. And I ended up taking this Akashic Records beginner class with my teacher, Helen Vonderheide, who's actually also in our class with us. And it was this profound feeling of like remembering, like even when she opened the door to her house and I like for the class, and I'd never met her before. And we just like looked at each other and was like, I know you. So like, even my connection with her, my connection, the feeling of opening the records for the first time was just like familiar in a way that boosted my confidence. Like, I trust this familiarity. Mm-hmm. And so I became very addicted to doing that, obsessed, devout.
Can you explain Akashic Records for anyone that may be unfamiliar, including myself, honestly?
Yeah. The Akashic Records, I actually don't love that term anymore. So the Akashic Records, in a very like new age modern way of describing it, it's like the archive of the soul and its journey. But it's derived from the word Akasha, which is a term from Vedantic Hinduism. And it refers to one of the primary elements of existence, which is the ethers. And so during like the Victorian era, where the theosophists, the New Thought school were like very obsessed with Eastern religion and Eastern thought, they found this concept of Akasha and they kind of imposed this idea of like, oh, it's a record of your soul. It's a record of all that can be known. Mm-hmm. And that's where we get the term that we use today. And I don't 100% resonate with that term. I don't resonate with that term at all, but I know that it's known, so I continue to use it. But we're really like tapping into the source moment of all that is possible for existence, of all creation. And we can, as a practitioner, as a very practical practitioner, when somebody books me, it's usually somebody that is experiencing some kind of stuckness somewhere, like limiting beliefs, traumas, challenges, patterns, relationships, things that are just like, oh, I need to unstick myself. I need to find a way through this thing. So we can open their records and we can find out if there's a perspective or if there's information or if there's a way of knowing that might assist them in moving through their conditions of their life today.
I'm wondering how your study of decoloniality and, you know, your working through social justice and all of that, how did that interplay with your Akashic Records study, you know, and how do you, like, this is because, like I mentioned, this is something I'm very interested with tarot, you know, and talking about the system of tarot and examining the system of tarot and how it is, you know, how there are some really ingrained issues depending what system, you know, you're working with.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, like, what started to come up for you as you put these two things kind of together, you know?
To be quite honest, my relationship with the records has pushed me into an even more radical decolonial, like made me more like radically open to decolonial perspectives because I was ready for it. I was ready to just be ripped apart, like take all my beliefs and throw them out and tell me what is available. And I mean, from the beginning, like the first class that I ever took, that beginner class, our homework was to go home, open your records and just see what happens. And I went home, I did the homework, I came back the next day and we're going around the room and all these women, these like lovely West LA women are like, oh, the records told me that I need to be more compassionate with myself and I need to be patient with my growth and I need to love myself. And my records were like, this is January of 2016. Trump is going to be elected president and this is the last election in the United States. And everyone in the room was like, why would you say that? Like, what is wrong with you? Just like, and I'm like, I don't know. I've never taken any, I've never even done a meditation before this. I don't know what this is. I don't know. He hadn't even really started campaigning hardcore yet at that point. And my teacher was like, go with that, explore that, like ask them about that. Mm. And as I started this practice and like just opening, and I was unemployed again at that time, so I didn't have anything else going on in my life. So I'm like every day opening, asking what's happening. I mean, they started sharing information with me about, you know, people that were being killed by the police. They started sharing, they confirmed, like I remember before the Kavanaugh hearing, they were like, yes, he absolutely will win. And it's because of this, this, and this. I mean, even to this day, they're like telling me what is coming in the 2024 election. You know, like, and of course, there's no one set future. There isn't in the Akashic world, there isn't. But there are very strong probabilities based on the things that we choose to do right now that make one future more possible than other futures. Mm-hmm. So I keep asking like, well, why are you showing me this? What's the point? Why do we need to know these things? What's happening to us? And they're like, this isn't the way it has to be. But in order to thwart this, people have to fall in love again. Like people have to bring love into the everyday experience. And love isn't just like romantic, googly eye, like just like gooey Hallmark love. Love is what they ended up describing to me as like, love is a combination of humanization and empathy, which humanization is the ability to see another being, see yourself in another being, whether it's a tree or an animal or a person or whatever, you see qualities of yourself in that being, which allows you to project your consciousness into the perspective of that other being. You're now able to see from that perspective. And when you can make that bridge over, then you can empathize and you can extend a sense of empathy and care toward whatever that is, a person, an animal, doesn't matter. And so then they're like, so love is actually an expansion of consciousness. It's the ability to project out of your human tunnel vision of your personhood and be able to see from another's, and not a projection of what you want in your life onto another being, like, oh, they must want what I want. Not that, mm-hmm. but the ability to see from them, which we can do with our consciousness. We can do that in meditation. We can remote view, we can do all these things. And so they're like, that kind of relationality needs to come back into everyday experiences, and it will push you off of that course. It not only pushes you off that course, but it re-energizes and reignites our sense of hope, of desire, of like feeling supported, of believing that there's help for each of us. Like it changes the way we exist in the world. None of that is how social justice approaches quote unquote liberation. None of that is how the everyday world approaches like justice, because everything I'm talking about sounds very weak. It sounds very powerless. It sounds very, that's cute, but what about the people who are in prison right now? Like for me, the records have always been like a strengthener, a fortifier of my decolonial education, because decoloniality really needs us to have an imagination, and the records open up that imagination for me often.
Yeah. Can we dive a little bit more into that difference that you're pointing to with decoloniality and social justice? Because I'm curious to hear you talk about that.
Yeah. So I just want to give a disclaimer, Nick, that if you get any hate mail, you can forward it right to me, because people do not like this when I say it. Well, people like love to hear me talk, and they're like, oh, poetics. And then I say this one thing, and then they're like, excuse me. So I spent many years, like almost two decades, in social justice, kind of like activist worlds, especially around education, oppressive education system, school to prison pipeline, all that stuff. And what I have now come to, and other decolonial scholars have come to this too, is that social justice is not decolonial. Social justice is a movement born out of colonialism, and it invokes often the tools and strategies of colonialism to try to achieve equity within a system that is never going to be designed to do it. So people are really, really all about racial justice, but rarely do people talk about dismantling competitive capitalist structures in the same breath. But we know from our study of colonialism, like especially like Aníbal Quijano, that race is a creation to sanction stolen labor for the benefit of like a extractionist capitalist policies and relationships that we still live in today. Mm-hmm. So social justice wants things that are impossible. And this is like what I think now. It wants things that are impossible. There's no way that we can have racial justice without also a massive overhaul of how we do economics. And not just here in this country, but our economics in the US has fingers in every part of the globe extracting resources, labor, you name it, from other people and communities, indigenous communities, natural spaces. We would have to bring all those cords back. We would have to get our fingers out of everything, you know, like in order to revamp how we exist racially. And often what we don't notice too is that like the heart of social justice is in the right place. I don't deny that. I don't deny it. But the way that it dreams of finding equity is often limited by the limits of what colonialism tells us is possible. And so decoloniality offers us an imagination space even to dream of other ways of being completely. So I believe that both agendas, social justice and decoloniality, want the thriving and sustainability of life. They want the dignity of life, I think. But decoloniality pushes us to reach outside of the tools that we've been using. You know, Audre Lorde's essay on the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. It doesn't, like, there's an author that, an Indigenous Canadian author named Leanne Simpson, that writes that shame is a tool of settler colonialism. And it makes us, and she's talking about her Indigenous students, feel shame in our bodies. Social justice is a very shaming world. Like, it shames you if you haven't done enough. It shames you if you're not down enough. It shames you if you're not working in nonprofits. It shame, you know, like, shame is never going to accomplish something outside of the threshold of what it is able to accomplish. Mm-hmm. Decoloniality, in the way I know it and what I believe for it, it asks us to not shame shame or punish shame, but, like, what even else is possible besides this? What else is possible?
If you enjoy hearing conversations like this one, please consider supporting In Search of Tarot by becoming a member of our Patreon community. There you'll receive weekly mystic missives discussing any number of philosophical, tarological concepts, along with discounts to upcoming classes and workshops, and invitations to attend our monthly tarot hangs on Zoom. The financial support we receive through Patreon is the only way that we're able to pay our incredible guests who join us week after week to share their knowledge and life stories with all of you. We are so appreciative of our existing patrons' generous support, and we invite you to join them at patreon.com/insearchoftarot.
I feel like you're pointing to that feeling of, like, the wheels spinning, you know, that can happen where you're just like, I can't see a way out of this, you know, I have to be surviving now too. And, you know, and just like, you know, that wheel spin. So I think the question I want to ask, and that I think people that are listening will want to ask, is, you know, how does change happen? I mean, because that seems like the common denominator between the two is that if, you know, both are wanting change to occur, and I'm not going to act like you should have the answer, but I'm wondering what you do think about that, you know?
I completely dropped my objective of wanting change. Mm-hmm. That's not 100% true, but I think, like, when I was teaching, I was like, we have to organize campaigns against this one council member who's taking away our budget for blah, 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 because I saw this thing happen. And so now we need to go tit for tat fighting to get change. And that is exactly a hamster wheel. That is just, you're just going to be running forever, because there's always going to be another thing to change, to fix, always. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, while I'm on that hamster wheel, I am completely losing sight of what I love in this life, my desires, my interests, what I'm good at, because I'm on this hamster wheel fighting for change. And something really interesting has happened in my life. And I think that it's possible for many, many people, is that when we maybe not decide that this system of social justice is irrelevant and ignore it, which I think we should do, but I'm not saying you have to do that. But, like, if we just take it and move it to the side for just a minute, and we refocus back on, like, what did I come to this planet to do? What lights me up? You end up getting into a process. Like, when you follow that resonant path, you get into, like, a life way that generates change that the other way, the social justice way, could never even dream. We fall into ways of being together, of balance, of harmony, when we are living through our desires. We are in right now the beginning stages of a mass extinction. We're in the beginning of the sixth mass extinction. Every 26 million years or so, there's an extinction level event. We're not only due for that, but we are approaching a massive, massive level extinction. That, and mass extinctions are noted through their, like, you know, 75 to 90% of life on Earth is wiped out through those extinction events. And we're right there. We're riding the wave. It's not too late for us, but the path to to moving off that timeline is probably not going to be tit for tat fighting against climate crisis. It's not going to be, oh, if you just get an electric vehicle, then we're going to save the world. Or if you just stop using straws, we're going to save the world. If you just, you know, like, because we're still living in an ontology that has not made an understanding of why we should not be engaging in these behaviors. We still believe that we should take without waiting for the earth to replenish itself. We still believe in extraction, and we extract not just resources, but from each other. We, you know, like all the time. And so I don't know how people will make changes, but I know that it cannot happen if we aren't obsessively consumed with doing what lights us up. If we don't get somewhat selfish with how we want to spend our lives and not bleed out to causes that only make us feel bad because we've never done enough.
Yeah. I'm just thinking about how this mirrors my own path with tarot and with how the past year, a lot of my work has been focused on critique, you know, of tarot. And I feel, speaking of edge spaces, that right now in my life, I feel myself to be right on an edge space of moving into telling my own story and like really moving into that power of that, you know, and the joy and the, you know, all of the, of queerness, you know, and I think like, in, as I listen to you, I mean, one thing that comes up a little bit is the sense of justice. I mean, like the, you know, and how you kind of feel like you want to be heard and you want to feel seen. And again, like if the margin is an unknowable place, then maybe you won't be seen in quite the same way, you know, like, and it's precarious, you know, like, I mean, it's really, it's tender, I guess is a word I would use, you know, because I can feel the power of it. I can feel the power of shifting into like, I'm just going to tell my story and like live my life, you know, and yet I also am the person who always is standing up being like, this needs attention. You know, we need to pay attention to that, you know? So it's very interesting. It's a lot of tension there, you know?
Yeah. I mean, but also you don't have to choose one or the other.
Right.
I think like there's a person that I study named Sarah Ahmed. She's a queer phenomenologist, and she talks about disorienting away from certainty. Like, in fact, I have a post I'm just about to put on Instagram about like being uncertain. Like one of the best things we can do, one of the things that colonialism does to us is it makes us calcify our knowing. I know this. I'm an expert. There's no growth here. I know this solidly. I'm immovable. I'm immutable. And that's so dangerous for us because we're porous beings. Like talk about tenderness. We're soft bodies. We're tender beings. We're constantly moving and in flux. But like, if we calcify ourselves, that's so painful. So like you might get to a place where you're like, I don't need to choose. I can do this. I can do that. I can change. I always tell people, I'm like, yeah, I do this now, but I could be a nail tech next year. We don't know. Like I might be something totally different. And the best thing that I can do is give myself that freedom to become.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Now that you're saying that, I mean, maybe it feels more tender because it is more marginal, meaning it is more powerful. Yeah. It is more, you know, and it is more decolonial. I mean, it is, you know, but, and so, yeah, I'm realizing now, like, I'm feeling encouraged to like keep leaning towards that tenderness, you know, like, because I can see how the fight and the, like you're saying, the sense of like right and wrong, or this is how, you know, it should be, or whatever. It's easier to grab that, you know, that's more tangible, I guess. So I want to just talk a little bit about living systems. You know, it's kind of cool to talk to you right now because we've had one meeting, and when this episode comes out, we'll be in March. So we'll be in another March world. And I'm sure, I mean, I already feel like a different person, so I can't even imagine who I'll be then, you know? I wondered how you would describe living systems, like, and kind of what you even mean by a living system.
So a living system is this idea. I did not make up this term either. So if you read, Maturana and Varela, which we will talk about a little bit, they use the term living systems to describe autopoietic systems, like systems that work and function systemically in and of themselves, and then autopoietic, like for example, the heart is an autopoietic system made of like the myocardial cells and like the musculature of the heart and the valves and the, all this stuff. But it interacts with the lungs, which is another autopoietic system, which interacts with like the, you know, all the organs in the body and the bloodstream. And like, so then the body itself is an autopoietic system that interacts with other bodies. And like, so, and there's like a, we're going to talk about sympoiesis too and sympoietic systems, but living systems is this idea that like, there are many beings within an ecology and no one being has more right to power, right to life, right to dignity above other beings. Ecological way of being tells us, we know in that way of being that like everyone here gives life and everyone here receives life. And we do so by being a part of a system, which is to be in relationship. It's to be relational. Colonialism does not believe in it. Colonialism believes in monoculturalism. So like, we will talk about this later in the class, but like, you're getting a little sneak peek, but like a colonial person shows up to a forest and is like, oh, cool, empty land. No one's using it. This is like a dead space. Let's raise the land and we'll put a corn crop here. But they don't see that this is a living system and that there are, you know, the canopy of the trees all the way down to the root systems and everything in between has a function in allowing forests to grow as its own being forever in perpetuity, like unless if something were to come in and disrupt that system. A really good example is like a terrarium. Like you can, if you can put everything into a terrarium, close the lid, you can leave it there for like 30 years. You can leave it there for a very long time and it will generate life. It will die. It will decompose. It will generate more life because there are everything in there has a function that creates life. So this course is like, it's like a dream come true for me to be able to share the perspectives that I've and the stuff that I've learned in my program, but also in like kind of a self-helpy way. So like I'm in a very like research-based academic program. We don't talk about self-help or we're not in that touchy-feely world, even though it is a psychology program. But the people that I work with are people that, you know, like people that come to me are people that have like inherent interest and like, well, how does this apply to me? How does this change my life? What do I do? And so I get to teach these things, this ecological way of being from a decolonial lens, an ontological lens, but I get to like put like a self-application lens over it. I get to put like a loving lens over it, which we don't do. And it's a year long because like I said before, I feel like we need a long time to be exposed to these things to let them work on us from the inside out.
And I want to zero in on a specific element of the way that you teach that I really appreciate. So I heard you on Jonathan and Mary's podcast,
yeah.
And you talked about the fact that there kind of is no objectivity when it comes to, yeah, you know, the classroom,
yeah,
and you use presuppositions. And yeah, I immediately started using that in my own tarot class that I was teaching. Cool. Because I was like, yes, this is it. I totally am on board with this.
Yeah.
So will you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Yeah. So when the presuppositions really come from my experience in my teacher ed practice, when I was getting my credential, that like really learning that like the public education system is not neutral, even though we're taught when we go into it, at least in the United States, and I would say probably everywhere, we're taught when we go into it, like you're learning math from a neutral standpoint. This is just math. There's no agenda here. Actually, that's not true at all. You're learning math, one, to be able to pass standardized tests, two, to be able to function in a capitalist economy. You're learning what you need to learn to either be a laborer, to be a middle manager, to be a capitalist elite. Like you're learning math at the level that the schools want to spit you out into a labor economy. Mm-hmm. But we don't talk about that. I don't even think teachers are aware that they're doing this. They're just like, no, this is the text we use. This is the, you know, blah, blah, blah. If we don't critically look at what we're doing as teachers, we won't see, we will take for granted what we're teaching as if it were neutral. We believe that it's just neutral. And neutrality is, it doesn't really exist. Neutrality does not exist. We're all in some way adhering to a narrative, to an agenda, to a bias. And there's, on the flip side, you know, like the colonial mind is like, well, how do I get rid of it? How do I be purely unbiased? And we got to let go of that too. That's impossible too. And not only is it impossible, but like, I want you to come with your bias. I want you to come with your experience, with your background, with your knowledge, and be your whole self. And you and I be in dialogue with each other, my whole self and your whole self, and see what alchemizes there and what becomes there. So I wanted to be very clear with my agendas. I wanted, especially because I know that I'm coming from a university, which even though we're critical of the of being objective and the zero point epistemological lens, we still have to be that. I still have to write my dissertation in a certain kind of language. I still have to like perform that role. But in my work, I can do whatever I want. I'm not like bound to, I work for myself. So I wanted to be very overt with like, here's what I believe. Here's what I'm imbuing into this curriculum. But then I want to supplement you with a bunch of other writers on these things so that you can see the difference between my lens on this and other people's lenses on this thing. So like, if you read the stuff on decoloniality, like the authors that I sent out to the class, they're not talking about like everyone's inherently good or like, you know, like they're not talking about the soul being eternal. That is not a popular or common take on decoloniality, but that's what I tell you. And I think I'm very like crazy about making sure that I'm not swaying people to believe what I believe. Mm-hmm. So I want to be very clear with you and all the students about here was what I presuppose. Agree with it, don't agree with it. It would feel misleading to me or deceptive to me if I were to obscure the presuppositions, but take on a lens of people are inherently good. Then it's like a cult. And now I'm trying to get you to believe something that I believe without giving you a choice or telling you why. So for me, the presuppositions are a way of bringing to light what has historically been invisible or hidden in curriculum.
Mm-hmm. You can choose how you want to answer this or if you want to answer it all, but I'm curious if anything's come up where someone really disagreed with you and like how that's been.
In the class or just in life?
Or just in life. I mean, because the reason I'm asking the question is like, I'm thinking about, I teach ballet and ballet is a very strange...
So cool.
It's a very strange like classroom to be in because you literally don't speak, you know, as a student. And what I'm thinking is, I'm thinking about, you know, other things beyond just ballet of like, you know, that the teacher student dynamic is sort of that the teacher knows a bit more about whatever you're discussing than the student, you know? Yeah. And so it seems like a really hard barrier to get over in this dynamic is like, how does it really become a more even playing field? You know, how are you really okay with the student having maybe less background in what you're discussing, but a different take on what you're discussing, you know? Is that? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we're seeing that right now with like the political divide, like especially like around abortion, where like people, very young people taking on like a pro-life position, who maybe don't even have the life experience to have a more well-rounded approach to their position, but believing they know better. And so, I mean, for one, I truly believe in my presuppositions. I really do believe that people are inherently good and that when they do quote unquote bad things, it's because they are attempting to meet an unmet need. We might not know what our unmet needs are. We might have no conscious awareness of what our unmet needs are. And it trickles up to the surface through our behaviors, our choices, our words. But at the core of that being is something good, a tender being, a soft body. And we go through a shitload of things, traumas, indoctrination, access to resources, not access to resources that shape the positions that we come to. you know, like I did a fieldwork project my first year in this university I'm in, and I was obsessed with like the border policy at the time, because that was like 2018. The fall of 2018 was when the first like 8-year-old girl from Guatemala, Jacqueline Maquin, died in custody. She had been separated from her family. And to me, I was like, what our world are we in? People are like responding to this girl's death. For one, there's not a big enough outrage, in my opinion. And two, people are responding to this girl's death by saying things like, well, she should have come the right way. She should have applied for asylum. You know, like things that I'm like, what happened to people, everyday people, people with good hearts, people that just want to live, people that are honest, working people? What happened to them to remove their empathy for a child of any kind of child, and from any country, from any race? What happened? It can't be because they're just bad. That's not a good enough answer to me. Mm-hmm. I'm related to the people that believe that. And I know those people and I love those people in my family. So I don't agree with them on their positions, but like what happened? And so my first fieldwork project was like, I want to talk to these people that are conservative. And I just want to know, how did you get to this place? Like, I just want to know. I'm not here to judge. I don't want to argue. I don't want to convince. I'm not here to tell you that you're wrong. I just want to know. And I only got one person. Like, most people were not willing to actually sit down with me. Mm-hmm. But disagreement to me is not, I don't know, like when I let go of social justice, I also let go of the desire to be right or better or mm-hmm. to know better for other people. I don't think any of us comes to a conclusion because we're lazy or because we want to harm people. I think if we come to harmful conclusions in our ideology, it's because that's what makes the most sense based on what we know, what we believe is possible, what ontology we live in, what resources we've been granted, what kinds of supports we've had, what kind of traumas we've endured. There's a story behind every person. And so for me as a teacher, the content is far less important to me than that you don't feel traumatized in my space, that we somehow can come away with like, we believe we live in totally different worlds, but like the bridge there is love. Like, I love you and your humanity. And that's as much as I can extend to you. Like if you know, mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I want to be conscious of your time. I feel like I could honestly talk to you all night, really. Like, it's such a treat. You. Yeah. But I want to close by asking you what you are in search of right now in your own life.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, I am in search of, I feel like I'm having an awakening of my own desires. I feel like I was raised to be practical and pragmatic and industrious in favor of being successful and good. And what that often meant was abandoning what I want. And I have a totally different perspective now on wants, on desires, that like those are impulses that arise on the soul level that are pushing us toward our resonant path. And that I could do what I think obligation wants me to do, be successful, make money, do these things in this one trajectory, in this one way. But it has a limit to the feeling of fulfillment that I think is possible. But when I listen to just what I want, even if it defies logic, if I listen to desire, it's actually a compass guiding me and guiding all of us on a resonant path to becoming more ourselves, in a way that like our conscious mind couldn't even imagine. And so I feel like a babe in the woods. Like, I'm not a tarot person, but I am obsessed with two cards, and it's the Magician and the Fool. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first time I learned about the Fool, I was like, ugh, no. And now I'm like, oh my God, I embrace it. I embrace naivete. I embrace like a childishness. I want to be like Bambi with a butterfly landing on his nose and just bewildered by the magic of the world, because I never had that opportunity as a kid. So that's what I want.
Yes, I love it. This part I'll probably edit out, but I want to tell you that I feel like this theme of desire has been coming up in a lot of places. And I Jonathan would be proud. Like I'm in Jonathan's astrology as praxis course right now. And I really feel like this, Mars retrograde, like had a lot to say about desire, you know, like that sort of, pulling back and stopping, like, which allows you to feel the desire, you know?
Yeah.
And I just read an amazing book about Cherokee Two-Spirit, people in history, and the author was talking about beauty and rebeautification and eroticism as counter effects to oppression.
Don't edit that out. That's beautiful. No, that is exactly it. Like the records are like, following your desires will thwart you off the course to climate crisis. And that's like such a huge leap. It makes sense to me, but it's like, how? But it's like, it's critical. We're not, and part of like the real oppressive part of colonialism, of like normative society, is that it makes us feel not only ashamed of our desires, but like it makes us believe that our desires are superfluous to everyday life. Everyday life should be producing capital, laboring, being successful, taking your vitamins, eating a well-balanced diet, you're doing the things that make you good. And that is such a lie. It is such a lie to keep us in our stratified labor classes. It's a lie designed to keep us laboring, to keep us hustling, to keep us chasing, so that they will always hold the carrot like right outside of our reach. But we can stop in our tracks and be like, I don't want that carrot anymore. I want this other carrot that's over here. And that carrot wants me too, actually. Mm-hmm. And I want to be that all the time.
Yes, preach. All right. So I want to let people find you and follow you and work with you. So will you just share any information you want to share about your offerings or how people can get in touch with you?
Yes. So you can find me for sure on Instagram. That's like the place where I'm the most active. That's Crystals of Altamira on Instagram. And then my website is crystalsofaltamira.com. Those are pretty much the two ways.
Amazing. You are incredible. I'm so thankful I found you.
My mind is just like spinning now that I know you teach ballet, because I'm kind of slightly obsessed with Pilates and bar. And I'm like, oh, yeah. Do I have the guts to take like a beginner ballet course?
Yes, do it. Do it. All right. Thank you, Leah. Yeah,
thank you.
In Search of Tarot is independently written, recorded, edited, and transcribed by Nick Kepley and Angie Miller. You can follow Angie on Instagram at birdgirl_, that's BIRDGERHL_, and you can follow me, Nick, on Instagram at In Search of Tarot. Have a question or a comment? Email us at isotpod@gmail.com. We also invite you to leave us a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts.